This is 15 Minute History, a podcast for educators, students, and history buffs featuring the minds and talents of the University of Texas at Austin. 15 Minute History is a partnership of Not Even Past and Hemispheres in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Samantha Rubino, a PhD student with the Department of History at the University of Texas. My guest today is Ben Weiss, who is a PhD student in African history at the University of Texas at Austin. His research aims to understand the early 20th century history of colonial STD surveillance and treatment in Southern Africa in order to contextualize more contemporary responses to earlier HIV/AIDS in the same area. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. So today we're going to take a look at syphilis and the politics of mercury in colonial Uganda from 1906 to 1922. Specifically, you'll be talking about the politics of colonial public health through commodity history by taking mercury as a unit of analysis, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
So why don't we start off by giving some background on colonial Uganda and the role of public health in colonization?
Colonial Uganda was a British colony. It became a protectorate, and so that came with a certain set of policies wherein there were colonial supervisors, but to a large extent, the populations that were already there were supposed to be more or less left alone within certain governing frameworks. I really want to seat colonial Uganda in the early 20th century in kind of the benevolence of the civilizing mission, at least as the colonizers saw it. It was about raising these populations, which were behind that of Europe, out of their situation and exposing them to new sciences and cultures. And of course, the indigenous populations didn't really have much of a say in this. It was just presumed that they would want this. And this is the story across much of colonialism in general. In particular, public health was seen as an investment in the colonized peoples, but because of what's at stake in public health, aka you have the general health of a population, this also has economic effects in terms of the labor force, in terms of the ability for colonizing education to be effective. Because of what's at stake there, it took a really malicious form in reality where it came to enforcing that civilizing mission and that public health.
So when did syphilis outbreak begin in Uganda, and about how many individuals were affected? Did it spread rapidly or was it more contained?
Where you really start to see a surge of this documented is right around 1879, where you have colonial reports of the Baganda and Banyoro, who are the major ethnic groups in the area. And these reports were just full of references to syphilis. And I do want to note that it's what appears to be syphilis, because there's actually an interesting twist that kind of comes at the end of this story.
Ooh.
But by 1897, and so we're crossing decades, and the syphilis is sort of festering at this point because they're recording accounts of it, but there's nothing really being done about it. But the Church Missionary Society actually initiates a formal survey and concluded that nearly 80% of the people they were testing positive. And that was then applied to the larger population. So the Baganda, in particular, it was reported that they had about 700,000 people in the area.
Wow.
So if you think about 80% testing positive, that's pretty insane levels.
Pretty significant. So when they were receiving these reports and surveys, what kinds of relief operations did the colonial British officials in Uganda conduct at the beginning of the 20th century?
In 1906, the governor calls in a man named Colonel Lampkin, who was the Army Medical Corps' top venereologist at the time. So Lampkin comes in. He confirms the earlier CMS findings about the rates of syphilis in the protectorate and framed this in his reports as the preeminent threat to the colony. And this went right alongside with the governor's concerns and kind of fueled the response in the colonial metropolis in Europe that this was a problem that really needed to be tackled head on. So Lampkin was given full rein to design a entire relief strategy, and the British government kind of told him, we will spare no expense in dealing with this problem within reason. Just tell us what we need to do. And so the strategy was designed in 1906, really took effect in 1908. and was active from that point until the mid-1920s or so.
Can you tell us a little bit about what this treatment campaign entailed? And it was Lamkin who headed the entire campaign between 1908 to 1920s, or did it shift hands throughout?
So it actually did end up shifting hands. So while Lamkin designed the strategy, he was not really the person who enacted it. So the person also from military background, his name was Captain Sparks. And he's actually an individual that kind of marks the maliciousness of the history of this campaign overall, because he's the person who's really enacting what I'm about to describe. And so in 1908, he comes in, he sets up a couple of very small buildings and oversees an effort that includes a prescribed 21-month series of painful injections right in the stomach muscle. And so those injections, which were mercury, were also followed by a topical cream, which included mercury as well. And so mercury was the main strategy that was recommended by Lamkin. I do want to note that mercury was probably the low end in terms of quality treatment. It was just the most expedient, the easiest to get to the protectorate, and the cheapest. And so there were obviously a lot of fears over mercury because, as you can imagine, it started to result in some very visible negative consequences that came from the treatment regime. And so the indigenous population were not all that keen to voluntarily go and get treated, especially since there was already a lot of background distrust from just the colonial effort in general. And so there are actually some fantastic primary source documents in which there are accounts of Captain Sparks publicly injecting himself with a full dose of liquid mercury, actually far more of a dosage than were being injected into the indigenous populations. And this was meant to calm the population's fears about the dangerousness of mercury. However, this actually wasn't effective. It was just more of a spectacle, because by the end of 1909, only a year or so after the actual campaign picked up, only about 2,500 indigenous patients voluntarily came to be treated. And again, this was just from one of the dominant populations out of a group of 700,000. A lot of historical accounts will say that this is attributed to 9 patients who very publicly and violently died at Sparks treatment clinics. So there are reports of seizures and foaming at the mouth, utter incomprehensibility in terms of language. And so this was a very public event, and this had a huge effect on indigenous fear of these treatments.
I can only imagine.
What ends up happening is not everyone was going through with the full 21-month series. And so you'd have people who come for 3 or 4 months and don't come back, people who come for 1 month and don't come back, people who will just appear every 6 months or so because their symptoms of the actual disease that's being treated are resurging. But among all this, you have other accounts that are floating around the indigenous populations. So there are miscarriages that are happening. There are blood disorders that are being acquired during the treatment series. And there was actually an account that stated that these mercury injections were an injection of fire. And that's the way in which this treatment series was being spoken about by the indigenous population. And so by 1913, the colonial records that we do have report that about 2,000 of the 5,000 patients treated by Sparks had died as a result of the mercury treatment. And so there are still records from the colonial side that perceived mercurial treatment as a suitable treatment as late as 1953. So there's a real distinction in the perspectives of, you know, what the indigenous population is saying and what the colonial population is saying. And of course, if you are a white individual in the protectorate who was diagnosed with syphilis, you had access to much higher quality medications. And so there's a interesting disconnect in the stories that are coming out depending on who you're looking at.
So before we get into the politicized response that you've mentioned, and I'm sure these tests amassed, can you talk a little bit about the timeline of early 20th century medicine that Sparks was working in?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because the actual scientific timeline is quite different from the historical timeline of the use of these treatments. So mercury and arsenic-based treatments for syphilis were some of the oldest ones, and they were actually far outdated by the time mercury was being used in Uganda. But in the early 1910s or so, Paul Ehrlich developed salvarsan, which had a slight arsenic component to it, but much less than the earlier treatments that were primarily arsenic-based. And it was just popularly heralded as the magic bullet for dealing with syphilis at the time it was generated. A couple of years later, you have sulfa tablets, which are also seen as effective, have much fewer side effects than the earlier treatments. And then a bit later than the story, of course, in 1928, you have Alexander Fleming coming up with penicillin. But as I said previously, you have documenting cases of mercury being seen as legitimate treatment until the 1950s, mm-hmm. which you look at the differences in these dates and it's just astounding. What we see in terms of the Ugandan timeline and the African timeline in general in a lot of cases is that the treatment is delayed anywhere from 20 to 30 years due to colonial calculations about the difficulty and costs of transporting the treatment supplies and the idea of population health by aggregate among indigenous populations. So what I mean by that is the colonial interest in having a healthy population beyond the rhetoric of the civilizing mission mm-hmm. was that the colonized have to constitute a healthy labor force. And so if we lose a certain proportion of that labor force to a treatment with significant side effects, that's okay as long as the aggregate health is mm-hmm. still at a level where productivity continues. The people who die as a result of that are just considered acceptable casualties. Whereas you look at the white populations in the area that became afflicted with syphilis, they have access to the sulfa tablets, later on the penicillin. They have access to the best medication because at the end of the day, they are seen as more valuable at an individual level.
So as with any controversial medical testing done on human subjects, right, what kind of political meaning did these tests garner in terms of ethics?
So in general, British scholars and contemporary scholars more recently have often viewed colonial populations as difficult to integrate into public health campaigns. So at the time, British scholars were writing about this, and the reality of the racism behind this has been developed by scholars more recently, where the British scholars at the time saw these populations as primitive, to put it plainly. And so they saw the idea of medical discipline, of returning for all 21 months of the series of injections, of taking the medication, of practicing sex in the way that they deemed safe under public health, as fundamentally affiliated with indigenous primitiveness and beyond their capacity. And so this is why mercury really comes into play here, because at one level, the colonial government isn't going to spare the expense of the high-end medication on this population that it doesn't view as worthy, quote-unquote, of these medications. At a second level, British scholars are responding to Lampkin's recommendations and saying that the mercury injections aren't going to work. They're not going to return for their entire 21-month series, etc. Lampkin actually responds to these claims and argues that the political structure of the Baganda people actually made it an ideal context in which to carry out these treatment campaigns. And what he meant by this was that in the Baganda governing structure, there was a monopoly of the chieftaincy. So if Lampkin and Sparks, who would end up carrying this out, could get the chieftaincy to agree to this and enforce this, then that provides
the others would follow.
It provides an entirely solid structure within which the medical campaign could work. And given that Lemkin was making the claims he was making, and that he was highly esteemed within British public health, British governance structure, and the colonial governance structure, this faith began to spread among the colonial administration. And so combined with the just innate fear of losing this labor population, they kind of signed on to his plan. And it ended up becoming one of the most coercive public health campaigns in all of colonial history. Mm-hmm. But of course, as with the civilizing mission, it was very clearly framed as charity and bringing public health to the colonial administrative periphery.
So how did these ideas of paying off chiefs and chiefdoms to kind of bring social order play into British authorities' ideas of political control?
So it certainly capitalized on the monopoly of the chieftaincy. A couple of ways it did this more specifically: British officials paid chiefs for reporting sexual disease cases. So it engaged this entire surveillance state within the indigenous governing structure. So this was a pretty widespread campaign where every single case of syphilis that was reported to the colonial government was rewarded. And so there was a lot of economic flow back into the chieftaincy. And so it's also important to note that because of the shock of colonialism, as hands-off as it may have been in that case, mm-hmm. compared to other cases, the chieftaincy was losing a little bit of authority within its own populations. And so that financing was very important for the chiefs in terms of holding on to their own power. Mm-hmm. And so while this was widespread, in about 1915, Sparks and some of the people advising him had deemed that this was not enough. They still weren't seeing the amount of treatment that they wanted. Locals were very clearly still avoiding the treatment, and syphilis was still very much so an issue. And so the colonial officers, from the documentation that I've seen, very clearly appear indignant. Their reaction is that of someone who provided a gift that was refused, which was very much so the way that they were conceiving of the public health that they were bringing to these people. This is where the coercion aspect really comes in. So the 1886 Contagious Disease Acts in Britain had been dismantled by women's groups decades before, but a similar variant of it got completely re-implemented in Uganda at this time. And it's important to note that up until this point, all of the public health campaigns in the Ugandan protectorate are being carried out by army medics. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge military component that, regardless of if it's being enacted, is still underlying all this. And so you have, under this re-implemented Contagious Disease Act, the idea of compulsion really framed clearly. And so there are cases where entire villages were rounded up by colonial police forces and underwent compulsory examination, were forced to undergo compulsory treatment as well, despite all the fears and the very obvious pain that had been communicated previously. These colonial police also hunted down people who didn't complete their injection series. And there are documented cases in which clinics saw about 60 women an hour. They were very publicly stripped naked. And it was almost like processing these women like they weren't even people. It's actually quite horrifying to delve into.
So based on my understanding of similar outbreaks across the world, I know these outbreaks tended to have linkages to prostitution, the uncontrollable female desire, and other sexual and gender tropes. Was this also the case in colonial Uganda?
It's important to note that this context is seated in an era in general where syphilis was associated with degenerates, deviants, prostitutes, etc. And whether or not this was true, this was at the height of ideology about what it meant to be civilized, mm-hmm. and what Victorian modernity meant. And so there was this huge fear of locals, especially in the colonial context, corrupting white populations in particular. So it wasn't just about the physical infection, but also the fact that there may have been a sexual encounter between a white person and a Black indigenous person. And there was a lot of syphilis that was actually going around Europe at this time. as well. And so there was this huge anxiety about the degeneracy of the white race, so to speak. And so combined with the association of syphilis with miscarriage, stillbirth, infant mortality, women especially became the targets of these campaigns. And so there's a lot of rhetoric of the women in Europe having been tamed and controlled, but the women in the colonial sphere needed to be brought under that same sort of control. And there's a lot of talk of the quote-unquote female passion. And so, unfortunately, women did become very much so victimized in this dynamic. Mm. And this also, again, coincided with anxieties in the chieftaincy, where women were seen as claiming more power in those particular chieftaincies. And so chiefs were very often glad to comply with Mercury to reassert their own internal dominance, regardless of the problems it may have caused for their own populations. And so this sustained the campaign until sometime in the 1920s, honestly.
Wow. So finally, kind of to wrap up, after the 1920s, what changed? And moreover, what lessons can be learned from the response to the syphilis outbreak that can be applied to other situations, such as the current crisis of HIV and AIDS?
Women ultimately undid the compulsory element of this campaign. So women's groups in London, a lot of the same ones that helped take down the 1886 Contagious Disease Acts in Britain, caught wind of news reports of this coercive regime in the Ugandan protectorate and immediately began protesting against these campaigns. So, for example, one female doctor who traveled to Uganda to take a look at the campaign ended up circulating an anonymous report in the British Parliament, which said, quote unquote, the campaign was the worst and most abusive public health campaign in history. And so general outrage ensued among European populations at large. There were references to the Ugandan campaign as barbaric and outdated. Mm. And eventually you see a shift away from the militaristic regime of this public health, where the colonial medical department actually takes over all public health and the Army Medical Corps fades into the back. So Captain Sparks is no longer affiliated with this campaign. And then you eventually have newer medications integrated, where you see African troops really becoming involved. You have much more of an interest, still a little bit in having an aggregate health, but each life seems to be a little bit more valuable. And so all across Africa, in fact, you have cases in Ghana where these troops have access to sulfa tablets instead of mercurial treatments. Mm. And so ultimately, I think that we find that mercury as a product itself occupies a space of huge political significance, both from the imperial anxieties it was utilized to relieve and the fear it instilled in compulsion, but also from it spelling its own downfall. Mercury creates a context in which it is able to thrive as the main product of use, but it also creates a context in which it's no longer sustainable for obvious reasons. And so I think that one thing that's really important for looking to the contemporary context, you mentioned HIV/AIDS, is that sometimes, at least historically, looking at the disease itself is not necessarily the best course of action for understanding how a dynamic may be functioning. So what I've done is focused the attention on the commodity of treatment itself. And actually with HIV and AIDS, if you look at antiretrovirals or you look at preventative measures as far as the commodities go and how those commodities are traveling, how they're being received, how they're being integrated, how they're being funded, it gives us a very interesting set of questions that are different from the questions that would arise from looking at the disease itself. I think if anything speaks to the power of mercury as a product as opposed to syphilis as a disease, the fact that research in the 90s actually showed that the vast majority of the cases that were diagnosed in the Ugandan protectorate for syphilis actually turned out to be YAWS, is a similar disease but not the same and necessitates a different treatment regime. And so I think the fact that these surveys got the disease entirely wrong it has some significant implications for the story itself.
Thank you, Ben, for giving us an eye-opening insight into medical coercion and mercury treatments of syphilis in the early 20th century Uganda context, and really opening it up to a more global scale of looking at different diseases as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
For a transcript of this episode, alignments to the Texas and National Standards for Social Studies, and links to more information on this topic, visit our website at 15minutehistory.org. That's 15minutehistory.org. And for even more, you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. The University of Texas is a free speech campus. Opinions and viewpoints expressed in this or any episode of 15 Minute History do not reflect the official position of the University of Texas or of any of its constituent colleges or departments. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.